This week, experts from the Humane Society of the United States exposed results of an undercover investigation looking at wildlife trafficking here in Connecticut. Yes, right here in Connecticut. So what did they find? And what changes could be made to stop the problem at hand? Joining us now back on the show is Annie Hornish, who is the Connecticut State Director of the Humane Society of the United States. And joining Annie today is Catherine Kohlberg, who is the Director of Marine and Wildlife Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. Ladies, welcome to the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Annie, if you don't mind, get us started. First of all, why have an investigation in specifically wildlife trafficking here in Connecticut?
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having us on. This week, we unveiled the findings of a disturbing undercover investigation into this illicit sale of elephant ivory occurring at shops across our state. This was back in November 2023, and we had an undercover investigation at 29 stores in 6 of the 8 Connecticut counties, and we found over 160 items suspected to be carved from ivory at 19 of the 29 stores in all of the 6 Connecticut counties that we visited. So
wow.
Yes, it was quite dramatic.
Was this based on like a tip or something? I mean, how did this even get on your radar?
Well, we've always known this was occurring. This is data to support it. This bill has come up in past years. Back in 2016, for example, we had a House Bill 5578, and that was going to ban ivory sales. And during that process, the Office of Fiscal Analysis produced a fiscal note with a statement saying that they estimated 4 to 8 cases may be prosecuted annually. So even back in 2016, there was an acknowledgement that illicit trade was occurring in Connecticut.
Wow. So, yep. Catherine, I'm going to move to you, and I want to know what your thoughts were when you realized that this was something happening in Connecticut. I mean, forgive me, ladies, but I feel like poaching, elephant poaching, for example, I mean, this is one of the things that was really revealed, is that local ivory markets are incentivizing the poaching of elephants and other species. And so, to me, I feel like I remember growing up and hearing about poachers and the real issue there. I mean, and again, I grew up in the 90s. So were you shocked at all to see that there is wildlife trafficking still going on in 2024, I guess 23, and it was right here in Connecticut?
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. This is a very convoluted issue. And like you said, we've all seen the horrific images on TV growing up of iconic elephants getting their faces slashed off to obtain their tusks for ivory to make, you know, pointless trinkets, statues, parasol handles. These are some of the items that we found during our investigation. So the problem is federal law prohibits the import, export, and sale across state lines of new elephant ivory, but federal law does not reach into intrastate sales. So the intrastate sales within Connecticut is unregulated. And so that's why we were pushing for legislation.
So again, we have Catherine Kohlberg here, who is the Director of Marine and Wildlife Protection at the Humane Society of the United States, as well as Annie Hornish, who is the Connecticut State Director of the Humane Society of the U.S. So one of the things, as you just mentioned, is the urgent need for legislation to ban the trade. I mean, is there anything else that came out of this investigation? Because this seems like a no-brainer. But were there other species or other wildlife practices with trafficking, in regards to trafficking, that you detected happening in Connecticut, or anything that you can give us an idea if you're investigating now? I'm going to throw that one to you, Annie.
Sure. Well, this one in particular, we focused on what we believe to be was elephant ivory. And the problem, just to expand a little on what Catherine just said, there's a difference between old and new ivory. Old ivory is over 100 years old, typically, and it's also sometimes called mammoth ivory. And that is legal to sell, but you have to have proper documentation to prove that it is old ivory. And that's something that was lacking in every single store we went in. There was no documentation anywhere.
What is it? So if you don't mind me asking, Annie, forgive me, but what would old ivory be used for? Because I'm trying to figure out why that would even be legal to sell.
It's very hard to differentiate. And even the store owners that our investigators spoke with had trouble explaining or defining what they were looking for to differentiate old versus new. And again, there was no documentation. So the problem there is there's a very good chance it's new ivory, and meaning from recently poached elephants. So that's why the federal law requires documentation of when and where the ivory came from. And that was lacking in every store, every single store we went into.
Wow. Where do we think it's coming from?
Catherine, did you want to take this?
So this, again, demonstrates the murkiness of the law and the need for a state ban because it's so convoluted. But each year, as many as 15,000 elephants are killed in Africa to supply the demand for this ivory. And elephants are a critically endangered species. They are steps away from extinction. They don't have time to wait. We need to act now. And all of this just for a trinket. And these are criminal syndicates who are smuggling ivory into the country. And wildlife trafficking goes hand in hand with other violent crimes like human trafficking and drug trafficking. So this is a major loophole that we need to close.
I just don't understand. And you just said it perfectly, Catherine, trinkets. I don't understand how this is legal, whether it's old ivory, new ivory, Shamalama ding dong
right.
ivory. I don't really care what kind of ivory. I just don't understand
right.
why this is legal at this point. I mean, we know, as I mentioned, that this is decades long that we've had an issue with poaching and for selling
right.
So I just don't get how we even are debating this. Is it just not a priority that's at the top of mind for lawmakers, or I don't get it.
Well, luckily in Connecticut, it is top of mind with the Animal Advocacy Caucus. They are going to be prioritizing legislation to close this loophole in interstate sales in Connecticut this session. So there are lawmakers who care very much about this issue. I think the investigation really demonstrated the problem and it uncovered the issue. But to your point, it does seem like a no-brainer in terms of the antique exemption. We plan to mirror that exemption in federal law, in state law, just because we want to stop new elephants from getting poached. People can keep their antiques given they have the correct documentation. But if they don't have that documentation, as none of the vendors in Connecticut that we visited did, then it's impossible to know if these items are from newly poached elephants.
According to worldwildlife.org, each year at least 20,000 African elephants are illegally killed for their tusks. A decade-long resurgence in demand for elephant ivory, particularly in parts of Asia, has now fueled this rampant poaching epidemic. And if you didn't think Connecticut had anything to do with this, you're wrong. In fact, there was some information that was revealed earlier this week that 19 stores in 6 Connecticut counties were found illegally selling over 160 items carved from, you guessed it, elephant ivory. This was an undercover investigation stemming from November of 2023 of 19 stores across our state with ivory products being sold at stores in 15 towns. And again, this is according to the Humane Society of the United States. Joining us now is Annie Hornish, who is the director, the Connecticut director of the Humane Society of the U.S., as well as Catherine Kohlberg, who is the director of Marine and Wildlife Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. Annie, you were starting to say before that when you went in or when your investigators went in to talk to these store owners, most of them had no idea what kind of ivory they even were selling. They certainly didn't have the paperwork to prove that it was a legitimate sale. We don't even really know where it all came from. What else was revealed that really kind of took your breath away when you were looking at the results of this investigation?
Well, Melissa, I think that's a very important point you just made. A lot of the store owners were confused about the origin of the product and even what the product was. In some cases, the owners would mention that this was, they would identify the product as elephant ivory, or it would be labeled as elephant ivory. And in other cases, they weren't quite sure what it was, but it just points to the difficulty of identifying ivory. And you know, one thing I do want to mention is we're not releasing the names of the stores because we're not going after small business store owners here. We want to simply identify the problem. And most of this, you know, many of the stores don't sell these products. So we want to identify the problem in the hopes that the Connecticut legislature will act on this to stem this trade. So we did find there were 29 stores visited, 19 had ivory for sale of that. And of the 22 towns visited, 15 had stores that were selling ivory. So this is the majority of the stores that we visited did sell.
So when you showed the results of this investigation, and again, not to shame local store owners mm-hmm. or anything like that, what is sort of the reaction that we're getting from lawmakers and the potential of passing legislation that will just ban any ivory-made products here in Connecticut?
Yes, the Connecticut Animal Advocacy Caucus, which is led by Representatives David Michelle and Nicole Clarides de Tria, and we thank them so much for supporting, prioritizing this legislation this year. And also, I would like to also shout out to Representative Kathy Kennedy and Representative Anthony Nolan from New London. It's important they prioritize this. I mean, we've had statutes on the book, for example, since 1989, DEEP, which is the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, they've had the statutory authority to adopt regulations if trade in elephant ivory was contributory to their extinction or endangerment, you know, of elephants. Yet nothing has been done since 1989. So it's time that the Connecticut legislature steps in and takes action and makes all sales illegal. And making all sales illegal is also, it makes law enforcement much easier. This is why the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, a former director, Dan Ash, was always very encouraging of states passing legislation, because it closes a loophole and it makes law enforcement much, much easier for everybody. And that's why we've seen 13 states pass intrastate sales bans, and Washington, D.C. as well.
It's funny that you say that. I was going to just ask that of Catherine. Shouldn't there be a federal passage of just banning any kind of sales for ivory products? Because, again, until you could tell me something that is that we would need to use ivory for, which I'm not convinced we do, you know, shouldn't there be something federal instead of relying on states to figure it out? I mean, states certainly can, but, you know, interstate trading, but also just in general, this should just be something across the books that's not allowed in the United States. Do we know if there's any effort on the federal level?
That's a great question, Melissa. And the Humane Society of the United States works at both the state and federal level to create policy to protect wildlife. So in terms of elephant ivory specifically, there is a near total ban on the sale of elephant ivory at the federal level. The import, export, and sale across state lines, so interstate sales, are prohibited for new ivory unless you have documentation proving it's an antique. However, the loophole is there's no intrastate laws, so federal law does not regulate intrastate sales. So that is a big loophole that poachers and traffickers are taking advantage of. And it's confusing. Connecticut consumers would be mortified to find out that they're contributing to the poaching epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Vendors are confused, and law enforcement.
Well, I thank you both for coming on to reveal this information to us. I'm very grateful that there was an undercover investigation here, and that these stores, you know, more than a dozen stores were looked at in Connecticut, and we were able to, you know, get the information not only to share with the public, but also to really push lawmakers to pass legislation and stop this from continuing. So I thank you both, and I appreciate your time here on WICC.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we, again, that was Annie Hornish as well as Catherine Kohlberg. Really quick, Annie, if people wanted to get access to the findings, is there like a website or anything where people can get more information?
Yes, you can actually go to the Humane Society Connecticut Facebook page. It's Humane Society of the United States - Connecticut, and there will be a link on there to read the report. And also, you can reach out to me at ahornish@humanesociety.org, and I can get anybody that information if they're interested.
Yeah, we appreciate that, Annie. Thank you so much. And thank you again, Catherine, for coming on as well.
Thank you.
Appreciate you both. Annie Hornish, the Connecticut State Director of the Humane Society of the United States, and Catherine Kohlberg, Director of Marine and Wildlife Protection at the Humane Society of the United States here on WICC. It's one of the top news stories, not just here in Connecticut, but across the country this morning. The roof of an early 1800s church collapsed in New London, Connecticut, yesterday afternoon. It is believed that Engaging Heaven Church and its building, constructed back in 1810, cannot be salvaged in any way, and in the day ahead, the two remaining steeples are set to be demolished. But what happened? Of course, it still remains under investigation, but we wanted to get some perspective on this. And so joining us is Professor Priscilla Fonseca, who is the Associate Professor of Civil Engineering, and she joins us from Quinnipiac University. Priscilla, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you.
How do you say your last name? I have a feeling I botched it.
You said it perfectly. Fonseca.
Oh, did I? Whew, I was really worried. I was like, Fonseca, or is it Fonseca? I don't know. You just never know. Okay, thank God. All right. Now that my complex is over, let's talk about the story at hand. What happened with this church collapse, in your professional opinion?
Well, so I look at two different things. One is that the collapse was massive, and then I'm trying to think of what kind of condition it was in, potentially, and what might have triggered the collapse. So it's a very old building, and it has that tall steeple, and you know, it's very common for some kind of structure like that to start to lean over time. And then we had a kind of a series of, you know, days where it was below freezing. And then all of a sudden the temperatures warm up and there's some rain. And so the ground is going to get very soft. So we had like kind of a freeze-thaw cycle. And my opinion is that it starts at the foundation. So there's a lot of reports about it being the roof, but I believe it started at the foundation, causing the steeple to tilt, and then it pulled the roof down with it because the roof was attached to the steeple.
Interesting. Now, when I was reading the national report on this, it was saying that the church undergoes very frequent fire inspections, but there was really no recollection of the most recent structure inspection.
I believe that. I believe that because if it had been inspected more recently, I would imagine that there would have been some clue that there was a, you know, a major problem at the foundation, kind of like how, you know, when you have a house inspected, sometimes, you know, a chimney is leaning and that could be, you know, a problem, a big problem later.
How does that happen over time? That probably sounds like a very elementary question, Priscilla, but is it a matter of just an aging building is doing just that? Like, how does it lean?
Well, it's the way it's constructed, it could have maybe not been, you know, piled down into the ground far enough, or it could just simply be a maintenance issue with certain connections down at the foundation starting to degrade over time. If there's any moisture that has been getting in over the last, you know, couple hundred years, almost 200 years old, then, or actually more, then, you know, that's going to cause any kind of connections down at the foundation to degrade. So it's really probably a maintenance issue due to water.
Wow. Okay. And Priscilla is here. She's an associate professor of civil engineering at Quinnipiac University. And we're talking about the situation in New London where an 1800s church collapsed. Almost the whole thing almost did. There's two steeples standing at this point, but they're set to be knocked down later today. Obviously, investigators still on the scene trying to determine the cause of what happened. Doesn't it feel like, Priscilla, and maybe you would know this better than I would, but I know just working in the news, it feels like we're seeing a lot of building collapses lately. You had the horrific collapse that happened in the Florida area, a couple years ago. We had the collapse of that apartment complex just months ago in New York, it seems. I find that we're seeing more and more of just these massive building collapses happening. And I know that probably it would be a structural issue. But it, do you think, in your professional opinion, first of all, that they're happening more often than we'd like to see? But second of all, do you think that the idea of having structural inspections, do you think that's taken lightly?
I think that, you know, it costs money. And, you know, we do spend, you know, the money. Like in Connecticut, we inspect our bridges on a very regular basis. But when it's a privately owned building, there, you know, it kind of depends on the state. But it, you know, usually building inspections tend not to be required. And in these situations where you have a large, you know, gatherings of people, it, you know, maybe we should reconsider that. I mean, if this happened on Sunday, this would be a worse, potentially a much worse story.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just it. I think we really are in the clear as far as, I mean, the big loss here is the fact that you have an amazing historical building that is now gone. And obviously that's a piece of history that we are, I mean, I'm sure they'll salvage maybe a couple pieces here and there, but it's just gone in an instant. But as you mentioned, this could have been a horrific situation where someone or a group of people, I mean, what if this happened while there was a mass going on? It's just crazy to even think. It's just wild. So, I mean, thank God, no pun intended, but it's like, thank God that there was nobody really. There was one person in the building and they got out safely. But again, sort of, I love what you said, which is that, yeah, it costs money. So I kind of am hoping that people sort of wake up if they own these older buildings. Like, what would you say? This is an 1810 building. You know, how often should they be getting checked? How often should the structures be getting checked?
Probably once a year. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah.
Probably once a year. Yeah. I mean, something that old. I mean, anything on that is that historic, and especially where you have large gatherings of people using it. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Professor Priscilla Fonseca, I want to thank you so much for giving your perspective from an engineering standpoint and also really highlighting the importance of it may cost some money, but when you look at what happened here and the fact that you dodged a severe bullet that could have taken lives easily, you know, a lot of lives at one time, if this was just a few days later on a Sunday, I think you really highlighted the importance of investing in those inspections. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right. And again, Priscilla is an associate professor of civil engineering over at Quinnipiac University. And you know, in talking about how this could have been just a much bigger disaster, just kind of breathing a sigh of relief to know that it is okay in New London. We are sad to see that the historical nature, obviously, that historical structure is going to be gone forever. But a sigh of relief that at least nobody was seriously injured or any lives were taken in this tragedy. But it does, again, beg the question, kind of like what we were talking about yesterday with a different professor in regards to investing in cybersecurity experts. Did you hear that conversation we had? We were talking about this article that came out of Forbes, and it was looking at, it said, the mother of all cyber breaches, and the fact that more than 26 million people have been compromised, you know, because of these data breaches and things of that nature. And yet we still have hospital systems, for example, banks, major corporations who do not invest the money or put someone on their payroll who's a cybersecurity expert. Kind of like that. You know, kind of like that. How many times do you watch horrible news happen before you say, hey, you know what? I don't want to spend the money, but I have to spend the money. It's sort of like that with this structural issue. If this was, in fact, something that could have been avoided by just having yearly inspections, that's certainly going to be investigated. So we'll see. But a very interesting conversation with Priscilla. A bill that would ban minors under the age of 16 from using social media passed in the Florida House this week, 106-13. House Bill 1 would require social media platforms to terminate social media accounts of minors under the age of 16. The bill requires that social media companies have an independent, private, third-party age verification service, that the personal data collected on minors under the age of 16 is permanently deleted, and data collected by the third-party authentication must also be deleted. It's like it never existed. Now, of course, the Senate in Florida still has to pass this. And if it does, the measure will go into effect on July 1st. So there's a lot of bipartisan support about cracking down on social media platforms, holding the feet to the fire for those CEOs, the people behind Meta, things like that. And even our own Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat, was praising Florida. Two thumbs up yesterday on our show. He said, yes, Florida's got the right idea. Connecticut's on track to do things like this. And we have to see more and more states jump on this. In fact, federally, we should all be on the same page. I wanted to know, though, what our social media consultant thought about this all. Krista Karn's back on the show with us the first time for 2024. She joins us now. Hey, Krista, how are you?
Hey, Melissa. I'm well. I hope you are, too.
I am. Thank you. I'm so glad to hear your voice. What do you think about this law? And should Connecticut maybe follow suit?
I mean, it's clear that people are looking for remedy to, you know, what people, like, all over the country, I guess Mayor Adams in New York City just said this, too. It's, you know, they consider social media like a public health hazard. You know, the Surgeon General, it came out in May saying much the same thing. Like, there's not enough research. We need to invest into research to really know why and what the potential harm is for kids. I mean, I think we see it anecdotally as parents. I think a lot of the messaging around this is that it's too much for parents to handle on their own, managing and understanding the platforms. And even, I think one of the Florida bill senators that proposed the bill said, you know, it doesn't matter how savvy you are as a parent, it's still too much. And I think the larger message here is that everybody really wants to squeeze the platforms to do something, right? So we have to hit them, or people are trying to hit them with, like, forcing them to do better. These third party, I think age verification is a really interesting concept. I mean, my initial instinct is like, well, everybody's just going to, all these kids are going to say they're 16, and then how are you going to know? I don't know how an age verification platform would work.
Yeah.
If you don't have parents,
And that certainly is something that I would need to understand a little bit better, because I agree. That was one of the things that I was a little bit confused about is, okay, so an age verification, all you're talking about is clicking some buttons here and there, change the year that you're born, and boom, all of a sudden you're not 16 anymore. So certainly that would have to be fleshed out, and I'd have to understand it more. But the idea of banning children, really, teens, preteens, from being on social media, I didn't hate the idea, Krista, and here's why. Because we are already, you know, things like marijuana, alcohol, you have to be a certain age to use those substances. Now, of course, are people going to break the law? Of course they are. Are people going to buy things on the internet? Are people going to create fake IDs? Sure, absolutely. But overall, the point of age limits or age requirements to buy substances that will impact you, there's a reason behind it. And the majority of the population follows it or gets caught or whatever. I don't hate the idea of saying that kids are not ready to be on social media when it's compared to being basically being on social media is looked at as addicting as fentanyl or other. I mean, this is what is being told to us.
Yes. And I think we have to remember that it's an election year. You know what I mean? So I think
yes.
We have to remember that, you know, this is going to score points for coming down hard on something that people are really upset about. But I think, you know, you have to be very careful what you unleash. I mean, my answer to that, the other scenario is, what if you had to prove your proof of age to check out a library book, right? Like, who gets to make the decision on what book, for example, somebody, you know, is old enough or not old enough? And I do find it a little ironic because there's so much going on right now about parental control and parental input into education, which I don't think inherently is a bad thing at all. In fact, it's crucial. But in terms of, like, curriculum and expertise and who is making these decisions, I should be able to make the decision, but I should – and maybe what it is if I decide that my kid is okay to be on at 15 or 14 and a half or whatever it is, that I could sign something that says that, 'cause this is just opening up lawsuits. That's what these platforms are scared of.
Yeah, and I get that. Sure, absolutely. And again, we have Krista Carnes here, who is our social media consultant. We're talking about Florida's decision to pass legislation. Of course, the Senate has not passed it yet, but it could be on its way to passing in the state of Florida, where if you're under the age of 16, you are banned from being on social media, and those platforms are expected to delete your profiles immediately. We don't have all the facts and figures, I should say. I don't have all the language behind this piece of legislation, but certainly age verification, that's a big one. I'd have to see how they're going to do that. But the thing I will say, though, Krista, is when you compare, for example, like taking out books from a library or the education system, all that, that's sort of like a requirement for children. They got to go through schooling. They have to do that. But I do think that social media falls under the category of recreation. You know, you're not required to be on social media. It's not like when you get a Chromebook at school. Like, so for example, I really don't like the fact that my kindergartner is on a Chromebook. I really don't like that he's got to bring home a Chromebook from school. I don't know why he needs to do that. I think it's just more work for me to have to now monitor another computer, and he doesn't need it right now. I think we overcomplicate the system. He's 5 years old. Anyways, that's part of the education system. That this is what they're living in right now. The times are a change, and Melissa, get over it. Got it. Okay. But social media, to me, as you mentioned, it is certainly a personal choice, but it's not something that, like, hey, the school needs you to sign up for Facebook. I do think that it falls more under the category of you want to try drugs, you want to try alcohol. That's something you want to do on your own time recreationally. You're not required to do that. So I do think there's a little bit of a difference with banning social media.
And I take your point, definitely. I think the question is, and I think if you dig into that Florida, into some of the reporting on that, no, none of those senators could name what platforms they're talking about specifically. Mm. They didn't say Facebook. They didn't say Instagram because maybe they haven't sorted out all the details. But, like, what about gaming platforms that have chats? And what about,
That's a good point.
Social media itself is such a broad definition.
True.
That it feels like overreach because everything would fall into this or maybe nothing. And, like, I just... You know, the thing about your kid's Chromebook is that your education system has invested the money in to make sure that they cannot access inappropriate content, right? So that's, I think, in the end, what we're trying to, what these laws and this movement is trying to do is force these platforms to take more accountability and take more action on all different levels, using research, and we've talked about this before. Like, it's not in their financial best interest to do so. They want to create consumers. They want these kids, you know. And so, yes, we have to protect them, but I think it has to be – we have to push the onus back on the platforms to meet those standards. And these kinds of laws are going to push for that. Even whether they pass or they don't, it starts to – at some point they're going to have to – they're going to have to figure it out the same mm-hmm. way the tobacco industry did, the same way the alcohol industry did, the same, you know.
Marijuana is probably on the way to doing that. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. We're talking to Krista Carnes, who is our social media consultant here on the show. After the news this week about Florida passing a piece of legislation, still needs approval from the Senate to go into law. It would ban anyone under the age of 16 from being on social media. We just don't know which platforms, but social media platforms. I would imagine, I'm not putting words in people's mouths, but I would think, like, the big ones, the big guys, TikTok, Facebook, X, Instagram. I know I'm missing them, but those are, like, the big wigs, I would say. But I don't know. I didn't write the law. Anyways, Krista's here. And I am curious, Krista, in your professional opinion, if Connecticut were to adopt legislation or you wanted to see something, you know, happen that actually would make sense for protecting younger people from being on social media, for helping parents to have a better grip on this, what would be your suggestion? What would you like to see happen?
Well, one of the aspects I think that's come up, and it's come up with the idea of federal and the Surgeon General actually encouraged this. So investment in the research so why do these algorithms become so addictive? That they are is probably not being disputed in some way, but, like, what is it about them? And once you have research, then you can force people to – you know, then you can say, see, this is the actual data that's showing that you're doing harm. So investing in that research. I also think that there's something about this little generation of maybe the last 10 years, and I'd have to, but yes, let's say just for the last 10 years, for those of us with kids, it's been an onslaught. It's been like an avalanche of usage and, you know, unlike, you know, anybody else, right? So
absolutely.
And I don't know that avalanche has to continue, right? Like, I think this is why it's such it's on fire for all of us. It's such a huge issue. But I think they would show that, you know, more media literacy in schools, teaching the kids how to use this stuff, because it's undeniable that these platforms do afford a sense of social engagement, a sense of connection with people, an exploration of positive interest. Like, it's not all negative, right? And just like with, like, for all of time, like, kids who are looking to explore or experiment or push boundaries or something, they're going to go seek that somewhere regardless. I agree that having this in your hand makes the access so much easier, and that is scary, and it's something we have to contend with. But I think we could go forward with a plan to, in much the same way that smoking rates have gone down, drinking rates have gone down among youth, because we've educated them on the harm that comes with it. So I don't think that's something you can change on a dime. I don't know if Florida was to enact this in July, like, how would they even roll it out? Like, what? I don't think they've thought it through, which is, you know, again, like, you know, I think that's why it's flawed, but I understand the energy behind it. I understand the desire. So, you know, can we educate more? Can we teach these kids how to use it responsibly? Because it is a part of their life. And so, and then when the lines are fuzzy as to, okay, well, I have to watch a YouTube video for my research for school, and it's a TED Talk by a very noted scientist, what if I can't access that?
Right. That's the thing is we certainly would have to see, again, I think, which platforms are talking about, which I love that you brought that up, because we don't know, you know, like YouTube. So YouTube, I would argue, is something you shouldn't be banning people from. There are things on YouTube that you should be aware of. You know, it's one of the reasons
you should have the ability to make a setting on your kid's phone that says that they can't access it. And
absolutely.
Be confident that there's no way around it.
Right. Absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, and the other thing, too, is like when you go to schools, if you use those computers, you cannot access social media. So
right.
Is that something that you can, you know, maybe that's something that comes down to the phone companies where I don't know if that's a control you could put on there that your phones don't let you access social media on the phone. Because if they wanted because that's another aspect is, okay, if this is the issue and you want to block it on your kids' phones, then maybe that's more the direction you go. And if they have access to it at home, it's in your own home, you're able to monitor it better or whatever. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, and it all, honestly, it all, to me, it all comes down to money. Who's going to pay for it? So either, and I do think that.
Well, Krista.
What if I travel to a state where that doesn't have that, and my kid starts a profile?
I think the social media they should pay. I think those platforms
exactly.
should pay for it. I mean, Zuckerberg. If I've got to hear about any more money that guy's got, I mean, any of them. I mean, they should pay for it. They created monsters. And yes, no question that we opened Pandora's box, right? We didn't really put any safeguards in place because we didn't know how big this was going to get. You know, you talk about the last 10 years. When Facebook came out, I was a senior in high school. And that was when it first came out. Like, I didn't have a Facebook page, so I think I was a sophomore in college. And even then, my parents were very, I don't know. And I'm like, guys, I'm 20. I have to try this Facebook thing. Everyone's on it.
It was so basic.
right, you know? So, yeah, and even then, exactly. That's what it was. It was basic. There was nothing to it. There was no messaging. I mean, it's cringeworthy when I look at the stuff my husband and I used to, like, put on each other's walls. And we were dating at the time during it's really, I'm like, oh my gosh, this was like public, like people could see my videos I sent to my husband. Nothing bad, guys, relax. But it was like corny stuff, and I thought, oh my gosh, there was a time that we did this. So what I'm getting at, though, is yes, in the last 10 years, you know, we were dealing with Facebook, even the beginnings of Twitter. What it has become, I just said to you, only the platforms I know of.
The mega ones.
There are so many. There are so many. And I couldn't even tell you which ones they are. And I'm not that old. I'm sorry, but I'm not that old, despite that my son thinks I'm 112. But besides him, I don't consider myself very old, but I can't keep track of them. So as a parent, I'm terrified of what my son will learn about in school or what his friends will expose him to or what he's going to get involved with. So we need the help for sure. And at some point, these platforms have to get on board with that. They have to in some way.
And, you know, there's so much talk about, you know, whether the internet and broadband is like a utility now, right? Like, you really can't function
in today's society. You can't. You cannot.
No, you can't. So if you think of it as a utility, then that becomes regulated just the same way all other things are regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, social media platforms are obviously intricately tied with broadband and internet access. So I think there's ways to do it. It's just going to cost a lot of money. It takes a lot of political will. That's what I think these lawsuits are showing, is that people are behind them in a bipartisan way. They want something done. And at some point, now, for every year that the whole social media industry delays taking action, but they keep it in the courts and everything, mm-hmm. they're still just making money. Right?
Well, that's just it. They keep pocketing and we keep struggling. So I don't know. We'll
so
see.
Something's going to have to come to a head.
Yeah.
And I think that's what laws are showing, is that people want, they want action.
We need something.
It's just how realistic is the action?
That's a good question.
And what's the damage?
Krista Carnes, I always appreciate getting your perspective. Thank you so much. I know we'll be talking again very soon.
Awesome. I look forward to it.
All right. Krista Carnes, our social media consultant here on WICC.